This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last of Breath, the podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato in association with Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. Dr. Catherine Mannix began her career in oncology, but found her true vocation in palliative care. After 30 years at the front line of death, Catherine took early retirement to focus on educating people about the process of dying. In this perceptive interview, Catherine talks about death, grief, and a whole lot more besides.
Catherine, it's a real pleasure to speak to you. You've just returned from New Zealand, haven't you? You've been in New Zealand and you're back in the UK.
Yeah, I had my second trip to New Zealand and spent almost the whole of March in New Zealand this year. Absolutely wonderful.
But it does sound exhausting.
It was very busy, yes. I was invited as a guest of the Australian New Zealand Society for Palliative Medicine, the New Zealand branch. And I was invited to speak and to talk about different things at their two conferences, which were the weekend bookending March. So clearly it's very expensive to fly a speaker out once, let alone twice. So instead of me coming and going between New Zealand and the UK, I had the great delight of being passed around a little bit like that game, Pass the Parcel, around palliative care teams and hospices across the islands of Aotearoa, New Zealand, for 3.5 weeks. And it was absolutely wonderful. People were so kind. I saw and met and spoke to lots of people involved in palliative care services around New Zealand, and they were very, very proud of showing off the beauties of New Zealand as well.
How do you think New Zealand stacks up with hospice and palliative care?
Oh, that's a great question. So I think the infrastructure and the intention is very good. The difficulty, of course, and I think the citizens in New Zealand understand this, is the funding. And the funding isn't on a sufficiently firm footing to be able to extend to meet the needs of every community that could be served. You know, when we build hospices and we declare that the hospice will offer these particular services, those services are designed to meet often a particular demographic. And New Zealand, very often, that matches a set of Pākehā values. And sometimes there are other communities that don't use those palliative care services in the way that we would imagine they should. You know, we have a view of this, and here is this service, and why are these people not coming? And unfortunately, we even sometimes, same things happens in the UK, describe those people as hard to reach. If there's something hard to reach here, it's the services, and it's because the services haven't been co-designed with different cultural values in mind. And there are some lovely examples of the way that is happening around New Zealand. I particularly enjoyed meeting the compassionate communities in Rotorua and just listening to the way they are co-designing services that are being embraced by Maori citizens in the area. So there's a difficulty of matching expectations, but there's also a difficulty of providing sufficient service, and that comes down to funding. And that's difficult anyway, because so much of the funding is raised by individuals and by charities. And again, we have the same pattern in the UK. Interesting to find that actually more government money goes into New Zealand hospice care than happens here in the UK, where we also struggle. But I think a lot of people don't realise that it's almost completely separate from the general healthcare system, and there's not enough government money. And of course, at the moment, you're facing an austerity drive by the current government. And so hospice funding is being lost. I know that hospices are having to reduce services around New Zealand. And that's a complete tragedy, really, that people who are reaching the ends of their lives are not able to rely on services that have been there for them in the past.
Well, you raised two very good points. And the first of them is pre-hospice. Working on this Last Breath series for Hospice Waikato, I have learnt how appallingly bad it was for dying people before hospice. And some of the most heartbreaking stories I heard was, well, not so much the person who was dying, but the way that the families were excluded from the dying process. The thinking was pre-hospice that, you know, we've got to save people the suffering and pain of watching their loved one die, so we'll force them out of the system. And the other thing, of course, you mentioned was Māori and how that all works. And working on this series, I've also spoken to Māori, and there's this perception that hospice is for Pākehā, not for Māori. And I know that this is being worked on, and people are trying very, very hard to change that idea, but it does exist.
Yes, it does exist, and to some extent it's probably not completely untrue. Maybe there's something about somebody coming with a similar set of values but not from within the nation to be able to comment, or maybe it's cheeky that I'm not from within the nation and I'm commenting, but I'll risk it a little bit. That I think we have had a similar, and we still have a similar difficulty here in the UK of designing something that suits very often a white, educated, middle-class constituency because the people who are designing it are generally white, educated, middle-class people. And they are very generously trying to imagine everything that people could need, but you can only think like the person that you are, and you can only think like the group that you come from. So there's a kind of groupthink thing going on. Now, what's really fascinating in New Zealand is that there is this very important minority population, Māori, who have retained links with their ancient culture, and that their own ability to care for a family and to respect and support people through elderhood and to acknowledge the approach of dying and the richness of the tradition as the person is preparing to, as they see it, transition from being here now to becoming an ancestor. That is so rich, but it's within their culture, and until we go and look for it, it isn't known by this other culture that's designing the healthcare services. So I think what we partly need is humility when we go to ask the people who we currently don't serve with the services we've designed to serve ourselves, what are you doing? What works? Why do you not seem to need us as much as we think you should? Tell us what your wisdom is and what you're doing right and what's working for you, so that we can learn from you. And if we have bits of service that will fill gaps that you have, please take them, use them, modify them, make them work for you. We're here to serve you. We're not here to make it be the way we think it should be. And until we have the humility to do that, I think we won't be able to weave a service that is suitable and available and flexible for any service user and the whānau that they come from.
The story that you're sort of telling me here is that, and I've listened to hours of you on YouTube, and I've just started listening to your 2021 book, Listen, and the message I'm getting from you on this subject is that we have forgotten about the process of dying, and now we are relearning it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I'm sorry that you've listened to hours of me, but if you have, heard me talking about my grandmother.
Yes.
So, and it's those conversations that, you know, the learning when you just suddenly have an aha moment where you just, oh goodness, I just hadn't seen that. And nobody else was in a position to tell me that, the thing that you discover for yourself. So my grandmother was born in 1900 and not into a wealthy family in Liverpool in the northwest of England. And because she was born in 1900, each April when her birthday clocked over, she had the same number as the year, which is great. You always remember how old your nana is this year.
It's very handy, isn't it?
It absolutely is. So when she was in her teens and her 20s and the 19-teens and the 1920s, so thinking about roughly 100 years ago from now, she and her sisters and her girl cousins will have been shown by their mother and their aunts how to look after people who were dying because, well, they couldn't afford hospital, but also hospitals generally didn't look after dying people because once you were dying, there were not things particularly that the hospital could offer. So by the time she was 23, which would have been, of course, in 1923, she understood dying, you know, from the inside out. She'd seen it enough times that she could recognize that there are definite phases and stages to what happens to people. And they would have understood at what point in the process, if important family members were to gather, when to send for them, depending on how far they needed to come. Or if they wanted to have a minister of religion alongside them, and there would have been various different faith groups in the area of Liverpool that my grandmother lived and grew up in, then, you know, when to send for the rabbi, when to send for the priest, when to send for the vicar. And so she'd seen it many, many times. Now, when I was 23, when I was that age, I'd just graduated from medical school and I had no idea about dying at all, even though I spent 5 years at medical school because I'd been educated to stop people from dying. That was the job. So over the course of her lifetime, what she saw was the beginning of modern medicine, the invention of antibiotics, better anesthetics, organ transplantation, you know, all kinds of wonderful things that medicine can do now, including for us in 1948, the beginning of our National Health Service. And so over the second half of her life, because she lived until just before her 98th birthday, so she died in 1998, over the second half of her life, people who were so sick that they might be dying were conveyed as quickly as possible to hospital in case the hospital could do something with all their fancy treatments that would, on this occasion, rescue them from dying. So that's not a daft thing to do. That's a sensible thing to do. But it led to that aha moment conversation, which was, I'd just become a consultant in palliative medicine, so my grandmother would have been 1995. And she said to me one day, you know, Catherine, I'm a little bit worried about what's going to happen when I'm dying. And I thought, oh, my lovely Nana, here's something that I can do for her. I can explain to her what dying is like so she needn't be so worried. And I started off on my explanation of dying spiel. And she just looked at me. She said, I don't mean doing the dying, silly. You know, I've seen that dozens of times. I'm not worried about doing my dying. I know that's simple. What I'm worried about is I don't think that your mum and your auntie and uncles have ever seen a person die. That was my, right. Suddenly a lot of things began to make sense to me. When I was first qualified as a doctor in the early 1980s, my elderly patients, because, you know, older people die more commonly than younger people, my elderly patients were quite sanguine about the idea that death was approaching. And as I matured in my career, as the years went by, those sanguine conversations became less and less frequent, and I didn't really understand why. And that conversation suddenly explained to me, the people who understood dying, you're probably one of the youngest of them, and you're 95. They've died now. And the generation behind them, my parents' generation, they don't understand it. In the space of a single generation, because medicine was so clever, we lost our understanding of sitting at deathbeds and recognizing the process, because the process was complicated by the medical interventions that were intended to save the person's life. But we didn't apply them judiciously. We did it to everybody, even people who were way beyond saving. And so dying stopped being a kind of personal, emotional, family, intimate event at home and became this almost medical ritual, which was judged by medicine itself to be a failure. You do everything you can to stop the person from dying. And if they die nevertheless, then medicine has failed. And that's embarrassing. And we don't speak of it.
Hmm.
And so we've lost the wisdom and the understanding and the patience and the ability to support each other and recognize the different stages and console each other. All of that had become forgotten. And the witnesses of it were the new death wives, if you like, in hospital, the people who sat with the patients who couldn't be saved and who the system was embarrassed by, but the nurses, the healthcare assistants, the palliative care services were still there alongside those people.
Hmm. And there's also an element of wanting to protect people from the face of death, isn't there? Well, there was.
I think that in medicine, there was, I think the protection was of medicine. I think it was a protection from people understanding that this system is doing its best. It's throwing the book at this patient, and yet they are still dying. And that, you know, death is defying medicine here. And so I remember as a young doctor, the big ward round along the old Victorian wards with the beds in two rows. But the patients who were very close to death, the ward round would tiptoe past those beds not to disturb them. And actually what we were doing was abandoning them.
Hmm. You start off your 2021 book, Listen, by telling a story about a woman whose husband has just died, and you don't make a very good job of explaining it to her, and you talk about your humiliation and your shock and all these emotions that are going on at the time. But you preface that by saying that we can learn from our mistakes when confronted with death. And this really resonated with me. My father died. He was cared for by hospice. This is about 2.5 years ago. And I'm not unfamiliar with death. I lost a sister in a tragic accident, which I witnessed. So that was my early education in death, and I knew it was a reality, and I've sort of been comfortable with death since then. But with my father, it was a different story, because it was several weeks lying in bed, being cared for by hospice nurses. And the thing that I wasn't prepared for was the emotions of other family members. And things things got a little bit crazy from time to time as people's emotions overwhelmed them, and there was arguments and fights and all kinds of reactions that I didn't expect. And it was a learning thing for me, and I came out of that much wiser. But it was also not very pleasant as well, and I wished I was more prepared for that aspect of it. Dealing with a dying person, that was something that was easier to deal with than other people.
Yeah, I hear you. I absolutely hear you. So there is something really interesting, isn't there, about living in a family that is the way families work. That's how we understand families, from the family that we grow up and are embedded in. And so our family's normal and everybody else's is a little bit crazy or a little bit different or a little bit unusual. And then we put this family group under immense pressure and things start to happen. And in fact, probably the oldest and most experienced members of our families are less surprised by the strange things that start to happen. That different people have different ways of expressing their distress or of experiencing their own stress. Some people become very quiet and very withdrawn, and some people become very noisy and very demanding, and some people misinterpret the other people's ways of behaving because it's not the way they would behave. So they now are in discord amongst themselves about the best way to be present or the best kind of care that this dying person needs. And some people want more treatment and more intervention and keep trying. And other people have already accepted that this is beyond retrieval, and comfort care and peace and quiet are the best things now. And because they fiercely love the dying person, but they disagree with each other about the best way to approach it, and there is only one chance to get it right, huge arguments can break out. And it needs very skilled mediation within families and by the health or care professionals who are involved to walk alongside families at times like that, because everybody's wounds are very tender. Everybody's previous bereavements, regrets from previous deathbeds are all alongside them in that room during that vigil. And it's tricky for families. Families are not misbehaving. They're just behaving, and we have to meet them with tenderness and clarity. Sometimes even we're kind of parenting, you know, we're saying that here is what can be done, here is what can't be done. This is the behavior we can tolerate on these premises, where we're also looking after other people and other families who have needs. And, you know, if you need to fight, we understand that you need to fight. Take fight outside the building, please. It's a form of really, really helping people to understand themselves.
One of the things that, when I started working on this project with Hospice Waikato, when I finished the first stage of it, I started talking to my friends about death. I started saying things to them like, "Have you prepared yourself for your impending death?" And I'm thinking of one friend in particular who's a very accomplished songwriter, and he's got years and years of his work scattered on hard drives all over the place. And I said, "Isn't it time you started?" Because neither of us are young men anymore. And I said to him, "Isn't it time you started thinking about archiving this properly? Because when you die, how are your family going to deal with all this?" And he said, "Well, what do you mean impending death?" And I said, "Well, you know, we're all going to die, and it's time to start thinking about things like this." And he was quite taken aback by that. But these conversations actually turned out to be very interesting. One friend of mine said to me, he said, "If I get cancer and I'm in hospice, will you promise me that you won't let people come to see me?" Because he said, "I want to die peacefully and quietly. I don't want people coming in and talking euphemisms and cliches to me." And I said, "Well, if that's what you want me to do, I'll do that, as long as you promise, if it's me, to keep religious people away."
So how fantastic, first of all, that your own experience has translated into the wisdom of recognizing that we are all mortal, and that the sentence "we" includes "I am also mortal." Because it's really easy to see that everybody else might be going to die, but that jump from one side of understanding to the other of, "Oh yeah, this is going to happen to me too," that's a biggie. And once we've got to there, we start to see living differently, don't we? So we become passionate that other people aren't taken by surprise, that they're not vulnerable to not being ready and not being prepared. So there are a couple of things that you said there that I think are really fascinating. One is that you've become an advocate. And when we first become advocates, our friends think we're a bit wild. And then gradually, as we keep bringing that up, they stop rolling their eyes and start changing the subject, and some of them start to listen. And that is helpful for them, because I think probably what we're doing is we're time traveling to 100 years ago, when everybody still recognized that we are all mortal. And "we" includes me. It doesn't mean we spend a lot of time thinking about it, because it's not comfortable to think about dying and not being here anymore and not knowing what happens, because none of us know. Nobody's come back to tell us. The idea of the void, or the idea of an afterlife that we can't predict, both of those are probably equally scary to a brain that likes to know and be in control. But having the courage to sit with that discomfort for a while so we can think about the things that matter for the people we love. And that's the thing that you said for your friend who's a musician, what's it going to be like for your family if you haven't archived this in a way that they can't understand? And, you know, their sadness and their frustration to have that genius musical relative whose music is lost to them because they don't know how to find it and what consolation it will be for them if they can find it. And all of us, we don't have to be genius musicians. We are beloved because of who we are. And if we can organize the messages we want to leave or the gifts that we want to give, we can give them before we're dead. You know, you don't have to be dead to leave everything. You can have the joy of presenting people with the things that you want them to have. And the most precious thing that we want them to have is that they understand how much they mean to us. And that's words and conversations or letters and cards or voicemails. It's not a thing. And we can do that. We can give that now rather than leave people wondering afterwards or telling people in letters and cards afterwards. And they think, oh, finally, I've known that they felt like that about me while they were alive. Our relationship could have been just so much better and closer. So our thinking about our death is a lever, isn't it, to thinking about how we behave now.
Yes, and once I started these conversations, and I'm having this, it wasn't just me talking to other people, it was me talking to myself as well, having this conversation about we are all going to die, and it could be tomorrow and it could be in 30 years' time, but at some stage it's going to happen. And mentally preparing yourself, even though you, in some ways you really can't make that preparation because you never know how you're going to feel once that diagnosis comes in or you've had that accident and there's no way back. But there is some consolation and trying to mentally prepare yourself for that moment. Now, one of the things that I've heard you say a lot is learning to live in the moment. And once you start having this conversation with yourself about your impending death, you start automatically to live in the moment a lot more. Every day becomes not, what am I going to do next week and how am I going to worry? I've got money worries and I've got to get this happening and there's work pressures. That sort of all sort of fades away and you just sort of get out of bed and you think, I'm just going to have a great day today and I'm going to do the very best I can and there's no more thought, nothing beyond that.
Yeah, I wonder whether it's a little bit more both and rather than either or. You know that today is, so I'm speaking to you from the UK, it's the very beginning of the day here, it's a beautiful, misty, slightly drippy, warm summer's morning. Everything's green and lush and beautiful. And I'm recognising it, I'm seeing it, I'm present to it, and it's beautiful. And there's a single red rose on the stem that hasn't been properly pruned. And instead of looking at the rose has not been properly pruned, so that it's got a whippy stem that reaches up to my window, I'm seeing the rose. Now, at the same time as that, I'm recognising that when we get round to pruning the roses this year, for them to thrive, we're going to have to think about that and perhaps take a different tack with the pruning. So I can be both present in the moment and also thinking about the great scheme of things. I'm trying to write a book at the moment. I find an awful lot of reasons not to sit down and do the writing. And yet, and I guess you will really recognise that. And yet, when I sit down to do the writing, it's one of those things where I'm the most present because I'm not even thinking about who I am or what's going on around me. My mind is in the story and that is being told, and that sense of flow during the writing is absolutely wonderful. But we still, you know, have to pay the mortgage and empty the bins, and those things also need to happen. So we can live in a kind of lighter way and appreciate that this wonderful moment, that beautiful rose on its long whippy stem that shouldn't be there, is a wonderful moment. But what's really great about that, the kind of sense of transience, need to understand and see that now, because it will change, the petals will fall, we will prune the rose, all of that, is that when we're in difficult moments as well, we also recognise that those are transient, that this really difficult thing that's happening in my important relationship with this other person, and I'm so stricken, or I'm so angry, or I feel so betrayed by what's happened, it won't always feel like this, that we will find a way to work through it, or we will part from each other with regret and sorrow and grief, and that too will change. And bereaved people listening to us will know that, you know, the early stages of grief where it is unbearable. How can I live feeling so lost and so bereft? Changes. And over time, when we look back, we realize it has changed, and somehow we are still here, and somehow there are still moments of joy, even though we live now with this grief within us as well. So I think that understanding impermanence helps us to relish the great moments, but also to tolerate the difficult moments while still having some kind of structure for making sure that, you know, we maintain our homes and remember to have food in the house for the children and things like that as well.
You know, grief, your first experience of profound grief is an incredibly overwhelming experience. And we're not really, well, I guess my generation, we weren't educated about grief at all. There was no talk about grief. And when it happens, it's you know, you feel like you can't breathe. Well, that doesn't even come close to describing how bad it is. Now, I was having a conversation with a friend the other day, and he's got two, a son and a daughter, and they're just coming up around 20, and their mother is dying. And he was saying, this is going to be their first experience of real profound grief. And he was wondering how he's going to handle that.
Yeah. And the answer is that he will handle it day by day and moment by moment. And there isn't a right thing to do. You feel your way. There isn't a manual. And those young adults will be bereft of their mother for the rest of their lives. You know, every new thing that they do that their mom is not there for will be another occasion of grieving her over and over again. And yet each time they feel that grief, it's kind of the doorway into remembering the love that was lost to them in terms of being able to exchange it with her. And yet it's still there for them because they're carrying it inside them. So our dearest people, after they have died, we maintain that relationship of loving fondness for them. But it's almost like a scar on our skin, isn't it? That to touch it hurts, but it's worth it because we also feel the love and the appreciation for them. So they will find their way, and grieving is the way we process those wounds to be able to function again afterwards. It's not a bad thing. It's a difficult thing, but it's not a bad thing. It's not a harmful thing.
And is it fair to say that we learn lessons from grief? We learn about ourselves. We learn how to deal with death better from our first experience of grief. Is that fair to say?
So I'm not really an expert on grief and grieving, and there's probably research that a wise commentator would refer to here that I can't refer to because my job almost stopped at the point where people were bereaved. And for a very long time, I was deeply uncomfortable in the presence of bereaved people because I couldn't help. You know, that I was completely comfortable in a room where a person was dying. I had a role in their comfort in making sure that everybody in the room understood what was going on, that the sounds that people make when they're deeply unconscious, their breathing noises change, and that disturbs and frightens people who don't understand that this is perfectly normal and their dying person is not distressed and uncomfortable. So I had things to do. And then as that breathing slowed down and stopped, I suddenly dropped into a place where, oh my goodness, these people are now going to be bereft for the rest of their lives. And carrying my own bereavements, of course, was my window into understanding that. And there's nothing I can do to help them. So I felt very helpless. And what's happened over the last gosh, it's 9 years now, isn't it, that I've been doing this, is that hundreds and hundreds of bereaved people have written to me to tell me about how, with the end in mind, has helped them to understand what it was that they saw and heard at a deathbed and what a consolation that's been for them, and how they wished they'd known that at the time, and how their bereavement has been to the point where, until they understood, and how their bereavement has been changed by that better understanding, how they've been freed from their assumption that the person was suffering as they died. And I've almost had a kind of bereavement clinic, a massive international outpatient clinic, of bereaved people telling me their stories. And so gradually, as in my job of working alongside dying people, acquiring wisdom by experience, gradually I'm acquiring a kind of wisdom by experience from these witness stories from so many hundreds of bereaved people sharing their stories with me, which is an immense privilege. So what I recognize is that every bereavement is different, just as every relationship is different. The relationship we have with the person, the manner of their dying, the expectedness or not, the condition that they had or not, the state of the rest of the family at the time, supporting a dying parent while you've got young and vulnerable and needy children is different from supporting a dying parent when the parent is in extreme old age and your own children are now adults, which is very different from supporting your spouse in old age or supporting your spouse who's the father of your vulnerable young children, or, you know, perhaps the hardest one of all, the dying and the death of your child and your grandchild. And each of those is different. It's not the relationship itself that makes it different. It's everything about that situation that makes it different. But you're right, we experience our first bereavement. And one of the things about the first bereavement is how shockingly visceral our response is to it. We thought that we were going to be sad. We had no idea that our body was going to change on the inside, that it would feel so much like being unwell, being chronically tired, having a rucksack strapped to your back every day when you get up, whatever the physical sensations are that different people describe. And then that lulls you into this false sense of security when the second big bereavement comes along, because you think, oh yeah, okay, I know how to do this.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the same. And maybe it's the second bereavement that really shows us that each time this blow comes to us in our lives, there'll be elements that are similar, but it will always be different as well. And perhaps we'll be less shocked and surprised by that subsequently.
On the subject of children, one of the subjects that kept coming up through this last breath series is some people felt that children should be protected from death. A relative is dying, we keep them away. We're going to protect them. And the other thinking is, get the children involved. They should be right there. They should witness and experience the whole thing. What do you have to say about that, Catherine?
There is good research here. There is good research here. So the first thing is, if I was talking to a family who were wondering what to do, I would first of all ask them what they think. And as soon as you start to hear the word should, you know that you're dealing with a kind of fixed belief. Children should be protected. Children should be involved. And so the first thing I would encourage them to do is think about changing the shoulds into coulds. You know, we could protect the children here to some extent, and we could involve the children here to some extent. And each of these children is different, and they're all at different ages and stages of understanding. But what we know is this, that children know when their grown-ups are unhappy and worried. And children know when there are secrets they are not being told. And children assume a worldview that's very centered on themselves. So if everybody's upset, I must have done something. If everybody's keeping secrets, it must be something so bad that it would be terrifying for me to know it. and they very often are of an age where their imaginations are so powerful. You know, our young children live in a universe where there are dragons. And so if we forbid them to enter the room, if we forbid them to see Grandpa, if we forbid them to know what's going on, what they will imagine will be worse than we can think beyond any imagining of our own, because their imaginations are so good. So the thing that we know is the most healthy for children is that they are given factual information without an emotional overload. So Grandpa is really sick. Grandpa's got a serious illness. Grandpa can't get out of bed anymore. The doctors can't make Grandpa better. Grandpa is going to get slowly more tired, and Grandpa will die. And then answer their questions. And the other thing that happens then is that children listen to that and then they don't ask any questions. And you're going, oh, what have I done? I've told them that stuff. They haven't asked a single thing. And then in the middle of something completely unrelated, a few days' time, they ask the question, and the questions start to come when they are ready. So we need to protect them by giving them an emotionally safe space. That isn't keeping secrets. It's the opposite. It's giving them enough of the truth that they understand what's going on without blaming themselves. And then the space in which they can ask the questions that they need to ask. When there are sibships, we need to also talk to the older ones about the fact that we're tailoring a little bit what we're telling the younger ones, because they can't understand it all yet. So if you want to talk about it and you're worrying about it, please come to me rather than going to your brothers and sisters, because what they can understand isn't as much as you can understand at this stage. And then helping them to ask their questions. And some children will ask their questions by sitting down in a conversation. Most children won't. But sitting and playing with them, playing in a sand tray, drawing pictures, doing, you know, Lego together, the being together, no eye contact time, that's the time that the questions come. You know, just as you're trying to get the very top brick on the tower and they're really, really concentrating and the little tongue is sticking out, and then they look at you and say, Mummy, is Grandpa frightened about dying? I didn't see that coming. But actually, this is the time when this child is able to ask this, because we're both completely entranced by the idea of this Lego tower and a moment of completion. You can almost see the little leap between that moment of completion and Grandpa dying, and we're going to ask that question now. So they need to feel safe. That's how we protect them, not by keeping secrets, but by giving them enough information and then allowing them to know. So the bedroom door is open. You're not forbidden to go in, but you understand that because of the illness that Grandpa has, he's mainly asleep now. He hasn't been eating very much, so his face has changed a little bit, and he's a little bit skinnier than you remember Grandpa being. Or you might notice that Grandpa's skin colour has changed a little bit, and that's because he's so poorly. So that they can come in anytime they want. You know, you can just pop your head around the door, say, hi, Grandpa, I've come to visit, and then go downstairs and play. That's fine. If you want to come in and sit with Grandpa for a while, it's up to you whether you just, you know, bring your cars and play beside the bed, or you can climb up on the bed with Grandpa and give him a cuddle. You choose. We're going to sit with Daddy today and we're going to tell him our favourite stories. He'll be listening with his eyes closed, but he'll be listening to us. So engaging them in activities that are age appropriate but not compulsory. So the door isn't closed, but they're not made to come in. They're welcome to come in if they want to. And it's hard. It is very hard, but it is very important.
Well, one of the things you've addressed numerous times, and I found this very interesting, was the language around death. You know, what do I say? What don't I say? What's appropriate and what's not appropriate? Could you just talk about that, please? I think this is really, really important. And it's something I've heard a lot, personally from my own friends and during the course of this project. Some people really struggle. They feel impelled to talk, during the death process. And I've had it said to me that, people would say just terrible things. Why couldn't they just be quiet and just be with us? The silence.
So do you mean sitting at deathbeds?
Well, after the person has died, at the deathbed, what's appropriate? How do you talk about these things? What do you offer condolences and euphemisms, or do you just is it okay to be silent, not say anything, and just be there?
Oh gosh, what a great question. So from my massive post bag of bereavement experiences, I think that I can distill out some really important patterns. So the first thing is that, we were talking a bit before about how individual people in a group that is a family each manage things in their own way. They'll do that towards the very end of somebody's life at their deathbed and in the early parts of their bereavement as well. So you talked before about families falling out towards the end of somebody's life, but they can really fall out about arrangements for a funeral, for example, as well. And nobody's got intended malice, just everybody's got a different view of what's the most appropriate thing. And so I guess the first thing is that when we want to look after each other and help each other to deal with something that's really difficult, but we're all dealing with that difficult thing. When the dad in a family, when my dad dies, he's in his 90s now, I'm one of five siblings. We all will have had the same dad, beloved dad, die. But each one of the five of us will have a completely different bereavement experience because we're grieving a different relationship with our dad. So we need to be able to recognize with kindness that although we're all hurting, we're hurting differently and we're grieving different aspects of the same person and the relationship that each of us had with him. So families perhaps think that what they need to do is talk and insist and say, this is what we should do. And almost the opposite tack is the thing that helps people to move forward, which is listening, really listening, so that the person who's shouty hears you, listening to them and then saying back, so what you're saying to me is, and I hear you saying that, and I hear that that's really important to you. Have I understood that right? Have I got you? And they can stop being shouty now. Yeah, you've got me. Okay. And then, so could you just listen to me for a moment? Because most of the things that you've just said, I agree with. But in me, it feels a bit like this, and this is a little bit different. And I actually wonder about this, and I'm really concerned about that. And so now we're exchanging and listening rather than each person going off into sorting it out and being the boss mode. But the other thing that I've really heard from bereaved people is a silence that is an abandonment, that after their person has died and the news gets out in the neighbourhood, people cross the road rather than walk past them because they don't know what to say. People see them in the supermarket and they change aisles rather than wheel their trolley past them because they don't know what to say, as though there is a right thing and a wrong thing to say. And that they're bemused by the idea that people think that they shouldn't mention their dead person in case it reminds them that they've died. Like you will never forget that your sister has died. I will never forget that my best friend died. We carry them inside us. And when somebody says, oh, sometimes I think about Maggie and I remember this, I have that twinge of pain of the absence of Maggie and this flood of joy that we're talking about her at the same time. And so we don't forget. So what are the rules of engagement for talking with bereaved people? Well, this is not from me. This is from, bereaved people is talk to us, say their name. Don't cross the road. if you don't know what to say, just say, I heard your news and I don't even know what to say. I'm just so sorry. Because the genuineness of that reaches out in a way that giving some kind of platitude, like, oh, you know, it was for the best, or they're in a better place. You know, how dare you? How dare you try to fix it and make it okay? It's never going to be okay. They're dead and it's not okay. But I'm sorry because it's painful for you. That's the right thing to say. And to be able to, I have friends who send me little WhatsApp messages every now and again. Oh, just thinking about this. And we're remembering our friend. And you know, sometimes they land at the most inopportune moments, but it's still great that we're remembering and that we're sharing the memories together. So supporting somebody's grieving by remembering with them, by sitting with them and just shutting up rather than trying to fix. And I realize now that awkward me in those rooms with a deathbed who had a job while the person was dying but felt awkward once the person had died, that girl, the younger version of me, couldn't fix bereavement and she didn't like the discomfort of not being able to fix bereavement. And the older, wiser me knows that actually that's just a ridiculous proposition in the first place. Bereavement is not fixable and nobody's looking at you to fix it. They're looking at you to acknowledge it and to walk alongside it. So to go and visit a bereaved person and say, I've come to see how you are. I've come to see whether you want to chat or whether you might like a cup of coffee and just sit quietly, or, you know, if today's not a good day, I can call another time. But what we don't do is go in and say, right, come on, let's sort you out. You can't stay sad forever. Yeah, you can. You can. It's okay to stay sad forever. You won't be only sad forever. But we can't fix it. We can just bear witness to it and be companions in that place of pain. And some of us like to have a companion and some of us prefer to be alone. So making sure we're giving people the choice all of the time is really important.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes. On Tuesday, I had coffee with a friend of mine who lost a daughter and a husband within the space of 6 months. And I hadn't seen her. This is our first meeting. And we sat down and we didn't talk about that. We talked about all kinds of things and we had a laugh and we shared information about the books we were reading and we talked about some old times and it was really great. And then all of a sudden, when she was ready, she brought the subject up and she said what was on her mind. And I didn't say anything and I listened. And it was wonderful. And I learned something from that because I was very nervous about going into that, have that coffee with her. I thought, I really don't want to say anything, but I felt that perhaps I should be offering something. And I'm glad that I didn't. I'm glad I just let her lead.
Yeah, and yet you did offer something from the very beginning. You turned up. You made the arrangement. You agreed to it. You were there. You took your awkwardness and not knowing what to say with you. And so many people fall at that point. Oh, it's too awkward and I don't know what to say. And I'm not one of their closest friends. And I'm really surprised that they want to see me. Oh, it's not me. It's not for me. I won't go. No, 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 no. And that appointment for coffee never happens. So by agreeing and turning up, you already were doing something magnificent. And of course, bereaved people are whole people. They're not only bereaved. There's all of this other stuff going on.
Exactly.
To be able to spend time with a person who talks to you about, you know, holidays and training the new dog and books that you love and things like that. Oh, what a relief to be occupying a different room in my head where we're talking about these interesting, fulfilling, exciting, joyful, mundane, but just not terrible things. And so how fabulous that she felt the space was safe enough. Just like we talked about with children before, children are only, you know, younger versions of our adult selves. You know, you'd got to the point where this is a safe enough space to say, okay, we can talk about this now. because I can see you're not going to be ridiculous. I can see you're not going to turn it into being all about you and how you're helping me and fixing me. So now it's safe to say it.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Catherine, and we're rapidly running out of time, but I do have two more questions. Well, two things I want to address. You speak a lot about the language of death and about being direct. Now, when hospice first asked me to do the Last Breath project, I said, what are we going to call it? And Cherie said, The Last Breath. And I said, oh, that's a bit confronting, isn't it? And she said, well, isn't that the point? And then I was schooled very quickly. It's not passed away. It's not gone to a better place. It's not da-da-da-da. It's death. And say death and be direct about it. And I found that incredibly liberating, and I've applied it to every aspect of my life. And it does confront some people. Some people don't want to hear that word, but it's very useful to use it.
I think this is really, really fascinating. So first of all, I think bereaved people and people who are navigating the approach of death within either themselves or within their close family, you know, we're not the word police, are we? They get to choose whatever words get them through. That's, yeah, absolutely their right. Hmm. But we who are providing the services or our institutions or our mainstream media need to be grown up about use of language that is clear. And so I think we should be using the words death and dying and dead with immense compassion. And sometimes people think they've been compassionate because they've used a euphemism, but actually there's been a bit of a compassion bypass at the same time. So I can talk with you about something that is so hard, you know, to be a young person witnessing the tragic, accidental, awful death of their beloved sister. That's a really difficult thing. And we dishonour it if I skip it by, you know, saying, oh, you know, that thing that happened. No, let's name it. It's up to you what words you decide to bring back into the conversation, because it's your grief, not mine. It's your situation. Mm. Well, when I first came to New Zealand, the very first time was in 2019, and I knew only that there was a very rich end-of-life and funereal culture in Maori tradition, but I didn't know any of what it was. And in the UK, I talk quite vociferously about not using the expressions pass and passing in a public space when you're speaking in a kind of official capacity. Hmm. And so for me to discover early on I asked to meet somebody who would brief me and try and give me some grasp of that. And I was very, very lucky to meet the wonderful Tess Moike Maxwell, who at the time was a Maori researcher in elder and end-of-life care at the University of Auckland. And Tess explained many wonderful things to me and has become a great support ever since. But the idea of passing through the veil is so central to Maori culture. Can you imagine how offensive I would have been, this little upstart British doctor telling people we're not going to use the word passing? Oh, that would have been so terrible. So it's about, we use our language, but we don't police everybody else's language. So I think that if we can't talk about dying clearly, then we risk people not understanding. And one of the common themes in the letters I've had from people, particularly where their person died in hospital, was that they didn't understand that their person was dying. You know, they were told that their kidneys weren't great and their blood pressure was low and they were very dehydrated and their liver seemed not to be working so well and the heart was going very slowly. And all of those might be, you know, if their doctor had told me as a doctor that that was what was going on for that person, I might have thought, oh, that sounds really bad. I wonder whether they're dying. But if you say that to people who aren't medical, they don't deduce that from being given the medical information. And interestingly, neither do we who are medical. It happened to me that the doctors told me about my relative and they gave me the medical information. And it took me a little while to fathom that they were trying to tell me that this person was dying. And I had to say, do you mean you think that this person is dying? Do you mean you think I should actually bring the family in here? And you could see the relief on their faces because I'd used the D word that they were afraid to use. So we risk being misunderstood unless we say very clearly. Now, it doesn't have to necessarily, you know, if you see the first time that you say dying, that the person is so startled and so hurt by the word, there are ways of saying it. Your dad is so sick that we think he might not survive the night. It's very clear, isn't it? It's not the same as telling me that his blood pressure is very low and his kidneys are winding down, even though that might be the mechanism. Your wife's illness has taken so much of her strength over the last few months that I don't think she's got the strength left to survive this. I think time now is very short, and it may be as short as a few days. It's very clear, even though it's not necessarily saying dying. But if we just say, oh, yes, she's very, very weak now. Yeah, she's very, very tired. And it sounds very kind, but it isn't saying. And if it's important for your kids to be here, you better make that phone call.
Oh, gosh, that is such an important point. Now, when my father was ill, the doctor came to see him and he took me outside and he said, there's no point in carrying on treatment now. I think we should stop doing all the blood tests. We should stop the medication. And he said goodbye, hopped in his car and drove off. And I'm standing there going, what did he just say to me? And I said to my sister, what did he say? What was he saying? And my sister said, is he saying that Dad's going to die? And I said, I think that's what he was saying. And it took us a little while to figure this all out. If he'd have said your father is dying, it would have been so much simpler.
Yeah. And so the fabulous Brené Brown says, clear is coming, unclear is unkind. And somehow we feel if we're fudgy and we don't quite say it straight, then we're not distressing people so much. Who are we trying to protect? You know, if I tell you something that is the truth and you receive the truth and it makes you very, very sad, but it allows you then to take the appropriate behaviors. My father is dying. There are phone calls to be made. There are things to be done to honor the way he wants to die. I give you the gift of being able to do that, but I may have to watch you being very distressed for a moment. I do wonder whether it isn't self-protection that stops people from being clear. They feel so awkward themselves when they don't know what they're going to do if this, you know, I've got, and partly it's because our medical staff are so overworked, aren't they? And again, same pattern on both our ambulances. Is that, you know, if I actually go into, if I say dying and then everybody gets distressed and then I've got to wait for them to recover themselves so we can have the conversation, and then I'm an hour behind rather than just 35 minutes behind my daily schedule for all of my other patients and appointments. So yeah, I wonder whether sometimes it isn't self-protection and perhaps even just subconscious self-protection. I'm in such a hurry. I've said, yeah, let's stop. Let's focus on comfort. That's told to them. And then driving off and they're left perplexed, unkind, but well-intended.
Well-intended. I mean, a lovely man, a wonderful doctor. But I get your point, and I think you're probably right. He was self-preservation as well, and you can't blame a person for that. Now, to finish, I'm going to completely segue into something completely different. Your 2023 TED Talk, you open with the statement, human beings are the only animal capable of contemplating their own death. And I listened to that, and it's possessed me for the last 2 weeks because I've spent much of my life working with animals, and of all different types of animals, and I have seen and experienced things that have confused me, confounded me, and transformed me. So I'm not sure if that statement is 100% correct, but it might be. I just don't know. But I don't really want to talk about that. That's for me to work out, and it's a fascinating problem to be thinking through. But the other thing is, one of the things I've learned from dying people is that they worry about their pets, their cats and their dogs. They worry what's going to happen to them. They worry about leaving them. But to take it one step further, the grief that we feel when one of our pets dies, you know, our cat or our dog dies or is dying, it's a very similar process when a human relative is dying. It's you're grieving in a very similar way. You're having to go through this process of making this decision, am I going to have them euthanized or not, and then the guilt that's associated with that, and could I have done something more, and have I failed in this way? That's, to me, that's just as relevant, the care and the love that we feel for our companion animals is just as relevant as the care and love we feel for our human companions as well.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, and I don't think there's a hierarchy of grief. You know, whatever the loss is, and for some people, their companion animal is their closest and most beloved family member, and we cannot ignore that. I've had such a lot of correspondence about that opening sentence from that TED talk. I can tell you, and actually, I stand by it, because although we know that many animals feel grief, and we know that elephants will remember and revisit the places where their dead relatives are, where they left them. I think we are the only animals who can contemplate the truth of our own mortality. When we take our dog to be euthanized, the dog does not recognize that in a moment it will cease to exist in the way that we do as we're approaching our own death. But I do think that animals recognize the death and grieve the death of each other and of their human companions, because obviously they think they're in charge and we are their pets, or their servants, actually. I've done cats quite a lot. and the loss of a family member for a pet is a profound bereavement, and their behavior changes and their appetite changes. It's very, very interesting to observe. The same in reverse, that when those precious companions who we've rescued sometimes from other terrible places, or we've nurtured them since they were balls of fluff or balls of feather, they are important to us. We're emotionally invested in them. We have a relationship with them, and we grieve them when they die, whatever the mode of dying might be. So I think it's really important that we can think about the kindness and support that we need to bring to people who are grieving the death of a pet, and not say, well, you know, it's not as if it was their child. It's not a competition. They're sad now, they're grieving now, this grief. And you may have a different grief that you feel is superior because it's a human and because it's your spouse, or we're not in competition here. This is about recognizing grieving and being able to be generous with each other, because grief is the price that we pay for loving people and animals. And as we pay that price, we yearn and we mourn, and it hurts us. And we only have each other to lean into. So I think we could be generous with each other, whatever the source of grieving. And there are other sources of grieving that are even harder to recognize. The person who realizes gradually or suddenly that they're never going to have the career that they longed for. The person who discovers that they will never be able to have the children that they longed for. The person who discovers that a person they've trusted their whole lives has been deceiving them, and they need to re-examine the whole relationship that they've had with that person and reinterpret it because of their discovery of that deceit. They're often described as disenfranchised grief. That people can't bring them to the table for support because they're often things that haven't happened to them, things that they were longed for that haven't come to pass. And so the whole of grieving, when you think about it, is the gap between our expectations and what's actually happening. That I thought I'd have this person in my life for many, many more decades, and they're gone now. And grief sits in that gap. I thought I would have that career, and I won't. And grief sits in that gap. I thought that I would be a parent, and I will never be a parent. And all my friends are becoming parents, and I have to be joyful for them. And I'm going to go through all of this again in another few decades' time as they become grandparents, and I won't get that either. Terrible, terrible grief for people. But they fear they can't name it because it sounds selfish or undermining of other people's joy. So grieving shapes us through our whole lives. And it's meeting people who are prepared to sit and have a cup of coffee and not talk about it that gives us the space then to be able to say, I'm struggling with this thing, can I tell you? And to be tenderly listened to and not told to get over it is the most important part of support.
Gosh, that was wonderful, Catherine. That was absolutely beautiful. Thank you very much for that. And thank you for your time, and thank you for this amazing interview.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me for this lovely interview. And, you know, I've got pictures in my head of the beautiful Waikato. I had and down where you all are, had a really lovely trip, visited the hospital, and just was blown away by the kindness and generosity of the people who are working in hospice and palliative care down there. So thank you so much.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.